Okay, so I've been appointed to teach this Psalm 13 to you today. And it's interesting to hear people's reflections this morning in prayer where I thought that was very good, how people are up here praying for people in other nations, struggling, natural disasters, all those sorts of things. And one of the things that struck me was a King's use of the word unfailing love. And that's a key theme for this morning. Okay? So maybe the Holy Spirit's trying to teach us something. Yeah, because I've been reflecting about in this psalm, it's you can quite easily think that it's a psalm about desolation, and it is, but it's more than that. And I was thinking about all the stuff that happens in the world, like in America when the financial crisis hit. You know, millions of Americans literally were facing financial disaster. They're losing their homes and losing their jobs, and a lot of bad stuff really happening for those folk over there. And yet this is supposed to be the richest nation in the world. And you imagine that the depression and what they're feeling internally must have been quite massive for them. And again, we look on the TV, the news, and we look at what's happening in the Middle East, and it's just massive. It's awful. Again, we see people being bombed out of their homes, having to pack up and be refugees, leave their cities, move to other countries, trekking through deserts, you name it, they're doing it, suffering persecution and death. And you have to think, what is going on internally? What's happening in there? In Africa, there's still grinding poverty in places. Ebola has just reared its ugly head there, you know. Thousands of people dying, you know, must have affected all the families. So what are they feeling internally? What's going on in here? Is that an aftermath that's going to always be there, even when Ebola's gone? It's quite demoralising. Natural disasters, you know, that occur right around the world and affect so many people. You know, you can have mudslides in Southeast Asian islands where they've deforested the place. Mudslides come and just wipes out a whole village. Everyone's gone. It's amazing. And so we have to deal with this stuff. We have to deal with the loss of loved ones and the grief we find. So wherever you turn, you can see this utter desolation of man without any problem whatsoever. And you ask for a moment, as an Australian, how good it is that we live in the lucky country, eh? That's the theme that's been historically with us. But then you have to ask the question, well, do we really live in the lucky country? Are we so lucky that we are immune from depression, from loss of dignity, from that demoralising desolation? The answer is clearly we are not. It's an ever-present reality in our society and in our experience. And so you have to ask the question, why is it so? Why is it so? As I read through this Psalm 13 here, it's just six verses we'll read in a moment, I thought about it and I gave it a title of From Desolation to Certainty. And we'll see the desolation of David, but we'll move through and see where he comes to a place of certainty. So let's just read it together. Psalm 13, verse 1. And you have to try and pick up on the emotion that's being written here. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. My enemy will say, I have overcome him, and all my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. This psalm is divided up into three pairings. And you'll note in verses 1 to 2 that David is in a place of desolation. As you work through, you'll find in verses 3 and 4 that he's in a state of prayer or supplication, seeking help. And then the third pair of verses 5 and 6, he just has this wonderful sense of certainty. So there's this whole transition that's taking place. And so within the first five verses, David is moving from spiritual despair to hope, from gut-wrenching internal wrestlings to trust, from deep sorrow to rejoicing. And then in verse 6, he sings about the goodness of God. So you have to ask, well, what caused these dramatic turnarounds? Did David return to confidence in God as he worked through the issues in his life? Is that what happened? Or was David revealing his emotions on one level, yet on another expressing what he actually believed? Well, whatever the questions, whatever the answers, David's struggles were not uncommon to man. They are the struggles of normal people, people like you and me. So if you look at the first two verses, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? So the outstanding question in here is, how long? How long? How long? And it's like there's no introduction to David's commentaries. He's not setting any context. He's not telling you what's going on. There's nothing there. It's just like this heartfelt cry sits there and says, how long? That's what's in his heart. How long, O Lord? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts day after day and have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? How long? And then his cry in verse 1, the second half, he says, will you forget me forever? He couches the whole question in the light of eternity. Is this ever going to stop? Will you forget me forever? And so in this cry of desolation, it sort of sounds like David's wrestling with God's apparent rejection of him in the midst of his deep sorrow. And his mind's working overtime. You know that feeling? Something's not good, it's really bad, and your brain is going non-stop. This daily sorrow that he experiences is not going away, and he looks at it and says it's never going to go away. And he sees the apparent triumph of those who are against him, and he sees that they will always be in a place over him, suppressing him and giving him a hard time. So I think David's use of the word forever, it adds a profound sense of hopelessness to his cry. He sees that. He sees his situation never changing. It's never ever going to change. It's unending. It will last forever until eternity. There is no hope this side of eternity. His neglect and his ruin are complete. He is alone in his sorrow and in his grief. He feels barren and bereft of any worth. And you sort of imagine the inner cry, a wretched man that I am. What's happened to me? And so you sense very deeply that he feels utterly forsaken. He's experienced a severe break in his relationships. He feels deserted. He feels abandoned. He's in a place of desolation. Now, on first reading, you could think that God has rejected David. It does seem that David does feel rejected by God. That's the feeling he has. But a closer reading gives a different picture. If you read David's cry to God in the light of his deep sorrow over broken relationships, you see David asking these questions of God. Will you be like my enemies and hold power over me? Will you be like them and abandon me? Will you be like them and rejoice in my stricken state? Well, the reality is that God has not forsaken David. And David knows that, I think. He knows God has not forsaken him and will not forsake him. But I think he has to ask those questions in order to get some perspective on his situation. Because the real problem is how David sees his situation. His mind is working overtime, trying to make sense of what's going on, trying to make sense of the situation he's in. But the truth just doesn't seem to make any sense, and it causes him great sorrow. So he cries out, O Lord, Will you hide your face from me as I struggle to understand and come to terms with the situation? So I think what he's saying, in other words, is, O Lord, you are the only one who understands. I need your help to understand what's going on. You are the only one who has not forsaken me. You are the only one who knows my situation. So then you have to ask the question. That's David's experience. But for us, what does it mean to be utterly forsaken? What's it like to experience a severe break in relationships? What's it feel like to be deserted and abandoned? What's it feel like to be cut off and to be in a place of desolation, suffering grief, having a heart of wretchedness and not understanding? Well, I can tell you from personal experience that it's a swift downward spiral into despair that never seems to end. And eventually it does. And only because you've hit rock bottom. There's no further to fall. I found in my experience as I hit rock bottom, after a while I enjoyed being there. So I didn't have to be anything, didn't have to prove anything. Everything was just on a level playing ground now. I'm nobody. There's no further to fall. In fact, death seems to be the next logical step. What else can there be after this? And all you hold dear has been cut away. Loving relationships have gone, never to be restored. A massive wound replaces a healthy heart, and self-esteem is stripped away. And your standing as a person is completely dismembered. No longer do you have any standing or status. You are anathema, someone who's vehemently disliked and disgraced. And no longer are you a confidant, no longer are you a guide, no longer are you a comforter or a provider, no longer are you a helper, you are nobody. And so depression descends and laughter departs, worthlessness embraces, and you are rendered powerless. And you know what? There is nothing you can do that will stop the power of this decline into total separation, total rejection. Nothing will stop you going into a place where you are despised and denied, distraught, dishonored and disenfranchised. You are nobody. You are nothing. You are surplus to requirement. You are condemned. You are the one to blame. And your desolation is complete. And I have to tell you, it never leaves you. And like verse 2 says, how long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? And the mind seeks answers, but they never come. That's my experience. And who will stand up for you? No one. You are alone and forsaken. Who will speak out for you? No one. The silence is deafening. And who will stand with you? Thank God for family and friends who stand with you in your desolation. And all of that brings us, I think, to the point of the psalm. In verses 3 and 4, David cries out, look on me and answer me, Lord, O God. David, look to the Lord for answers. There was no one else to turn to. And his prayer of supplication just faced a grim reality. The only place that he would find an answer is in the counsel of God. Nowhere else. He would not find an answer from those who despised him or any other. And so his appeal to God has an intensity and a focus. It's an intentional gaze into heaven seeking God's counsel. He's looking for a place of dependency. He's seeking help in a time of deep, deep trouble. And he appeals for light on the matter. He seeks the wisdom of God that will lighten the heart. The only other option is death. And so he's feeling this tremendous divide between desolation and the desirable notions of life and prosperity and happiness, but the latter have gone, and the former has come. He's in a place of utter desolation. So have a look in verse 3, the second half. He says, give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. And it's like David has grounded his request for light in the creative nature of God. It looks like he's pointing back to Genesis 1:3, where it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. You see, the Hebrew people habitually imagined all the joyous emotions of the mind, all the pleasing sensations of the body, all the happy hours of family life. They believed they were all derived from the light of God. So you think, well, was David looking back to Numbers 6:25? The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. Or was he thinking about Ezra, who said, God gives light to our eyes and a little relief in our bondage? It's resonating with that stuff, seeking the light of God. I think he was looking for the wisdom of God that lights up a person's face. Ecclesiastes 8:1 says, who is like the wise? Who knows the explanation of things? A person's wisdom brightens their face and changes its hard appearance. Yeah? I love James 3:17. This is a particular verse that I just have used and lived by, tried to. It says, the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. You want to read the preceding verses, and you'll see the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of Satan is disgusting. But here we have the wisdom of God. It's the wisdom of God that lights up the face because it lightens up the heart with the wisdom of God. And this wisdom from God is paramount in the verse of in the light of verse 4. In verse 4, we see that David is not unclear about the attitudes of his enemies. Have a look at verse 4. My enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. That's his situation. So David sought the true light of God, the wisdom of God, in the face of hatred and despising, because he knew the light of God would bring his wisdom, the wisdom of God that would light up his face. And he knew the light of God would bring justice and righteousness, guidance, deliverance, and certainty. Which brings us to the third pair, verses 5 and 6. Read with me with verse 5. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. As David sought God, the person of God and his wisdom, he came to feel safe and secure. In spite of the desolation he's feeling, he came to feel safe and secure, resting in the wisdom of God, resting in the character of God. He understood God's character. And so he trusted God's loving kindness and mercy. He trusted God's goodness and faithfulness. He trusted God's justice and unfailing love. So his perspective changed dramatically. He had a radical change in his thinking, still in a place of desolation, but having a different perspective. And so his rest in God's unfailing love allowed him to rejoice in the midst of his desolation, despite his enemies, despite his deep sense of desolation, despite being alone undone. He was able to cry out in victory, I have trusted in your unfailing love and mercy. My heart rejoices in your salvation deliverance. In you I have victory over my desolation. His situation is still the same. Physically nothing has changed. His enemies are still after him. But he has come to a place of complete dependence and trust in God. So his feeling of desolation and despair have been replaced with a heart that sings in verse 6. Read it. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. So he's moved from there to here, and seeing that God's unfailing love, and he's able to trust God and feel safe and secure, even though this is still the same. As I was thinking this through, I was thinking now, does God understand desolation? Does he know what he's like? I asked that question at the beginning, why is it so? What is the cause of so much desolation? And the answer is simple, the sin of man. It's the sin of man that drove the Son of God to the cross and his desolation. On the cross, Jesus cried out that ultimate cry of desolation, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why indeed? Father, why have you turned your back on me? The answer is that God cannot look upon sin. God made his Son a curse and poured all... Jesus bore all this, our sin on his shoulders. He bore all the punishment for our sin. And there he was, the suffering servant, in utter desolation, hanging on the cross, dealing with our sin. And the Father having to turn his back on him and walk away. I often think about that, that moment in time, the Godhead, the Trinity, triune God, has been triune for eternity. But our sin caused that break for a moment where the Father turned away from the Son, could not look upon sin. There's another truth that should not be missed. The natural extension of our union with Christ is suffering. Christ is our suffering servant. And if we are truly one with him, then we must suffer too. It's a package deal. But we must highlight the fact that he shares in our sufferings. Here's a quote from a guy called Ajith Fernando. He says, "The exalted Christ, sharing in the glory of God, is not deaf to our cries of pain as we suffer. He himself suffers with us when we suffer." That's our suffering Saviour, the one who will suffer because we suffer. So what do we do when we see someone suffering, this sense of desolation, the awfulness of it all, deep, deep, deep desolation? It's not uncommon. For many people, it's a real reality. So how do we stand with them? Well, I think by being a listening, non-judgmental confidant is so important. Come alongside, to listen and be non-judgmental. And to listen for the cues that signal the depths of their desolation. And to pray for them, pray with them. And maybe just write a prayer for them, because for somebody who's in a place of utter, utter desolation, can't even think straight, let alone pray. So maybe if you wrote a prayer out for them and gave the prayer to them, their mind's not going to think to pray, but you can give them one that they can read. Maybe that's a start in that place. And you can pray for them and pray the compassion of God will lead them out of their desolation to the unfailing love of God, the same as for David. You could pray for them that their faith will be rock solid in the midst of the pain. You can pray for them that they may see the only true place where they are accepted and loved is in the Godhead. Pray for them that they may sense deeply the hope of Christ and the reality of his resurrection. Because one day all of this stuff will be made right, and that's my hope, that one day all this stuff will be made right and sin will no longer reign. And I pray, you could pray that God will take them from their place of desolation into the certain and sure hope of the unfailing love of God, his light and his wisdom. Yeah, well, I think I'll finish there.